Sounds happy.
Yes, she does.
I can hardly blame her.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, there's in Tennessee.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
For once.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. Also on other fine affiliates in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, not to mention all of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. As you can tell, it's a totally slow news day today. I guess listeners may not be able to see my eye roll via radio, Desi Doyen.
Yeah, probably not.
In any event, lots to cover today because there's a lot going on. It is not a slow news day at all, so we will do our best to sort of, unfortunately, cull things down to today's most absolutely critical stories for the moment. Somehow, since I want to get to that story you heard at the top that is not getting nearly enough time today. Somewhat understandably, given the former president of the United States is on criminal trial for the first time in U.S. history and opening statements played out on Monday. But there was a huge victory for labor and union organizers down in Tennessee late on Friday. And we will be joined by a longtime labor journalist to discuss what United Auto Workers President Sean Fain is describing as, quote, the first domino to fall regarding the long overdue unionization of longtime non-union auto plants across the South and elsewhere, beginning in Chattanooga on Friday at a Volkswagen plant following a last-ditch, if failed, effort by no less than 6 Southern state Republican governors to try and scuttle it. Didn't work. Spoiler alert. Before we get to that, and today's Trump trial news, let's begin with the other big news that happened on Saturday when there was a long overdue victory for global democracy in, of all places, the GOP-controlled, and I use that term lightly at this point, GOP-controlled U.S. House of Representatives, thanks to, and I am shocked to say it, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, in partnership with all of the House Democrats who he was forced to work with in order to pass desperately needed funding for Ukraine's defensive war against its imperialistic invading Russian neighbor. The House on Saturday approved $95 billion in foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, including residents of war-torn Gaza, and other U.S. allies in a rare weekend session as all Democrats and a minority of Republicans banded together after months of hard right resistance over renewed American support for repelling Russia's invasion. The vote, once it was finally allowed by Speaker Johnson, was overwhelmingly in support on Saturday with the $6 billion in military and humanitarian aid and economic assistance for Ukraine. $61 billion in military and humanitarian aid and economic assistance for Ukraine passing in a matter of minutes. Many Democrats cheered on the House floor, waved blue and yellow flags of Ukraine. In the bargain, Speaker Johnson, who held held up a vote on aid to Ukraine for months, as what is being described as the far right of his caucus objected to such a vote, Even though it wasn't just the so-called hard right, it was actually a majority of the Republican caucus that voted against aid to our war-torn allies defending democracy in Ukraine. Johnson had held up a vote on that package for months with threats from Marjorie Taylor Greene and others that a vote would be called to remove him from his job if he moved forward with it. That before he suddenly changed his tune last week, though it's not entirely clear why he did that, risking his job as speaker in the bargain. A weary Mike Johnson said, quote, "We did our work here, and I think history will judge it well." After marshaling the package to passage, President Biden spoke separately with Johnson and Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries to thank them for, quote, "putting our national security first by advancing the legislation." President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine said on Twitter that he was, quote, "grateful to both parties in the House and, quote, personally to Speaker Mike Johnson for the decision that keeps history on the right track. Thank you, America," Zelensky added. It was quite a weekend as all of this played out. In all, the package approved by the House over the weekend totals about $95 billion. Senate passage is expected to come this week, followed by signatures from the president, who's vowed to sign all of these bills quickly. They break down to about $61 billion for Ukraine and for replenishing U.S. weapons stockpiles, which have been depleted after sending so much to both Ukraine and Israel and elsewhere in recent months. The overall amount provided to Ukraine for the purchase of weapons would be about $13.8 billion. Ukraine would receive more than $9 billion of economic assistance in the form of forgivable loans. And the rest largely goes to rebuild U.S. stockpiles. So that money essentially stays here. About $26 billion goes to supporting Israel and providing humanitarian relief for people in Gaza, which Democrats insisted on in exchange for their support for spending for Israel itself. About $4 billion of that would be dedicated to replenishing Israel's missile defense systems, and more than $9 billion of the total would go toward humanitarian assistance in Gaza. And then there's another $8 billion earmarked toward helping U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region, with more than $3 billion towards submarine infrastructure and development and an additional nearly $2 billion to replenish U.S. weapons provided to Taiwan and other regional allies. So that's what happened, a little bit of what happened in the U.S. House over the weekend.
A little bit, but it was a big deal.
It was a big deal, and I think there's still a lot more of fallout that is still to come. We'll see if the Republicans will actually call this motion to vacate against Speaker Mike Johnson. Meanwhile, in New York City on Monday, Donald Trump, quote, "orchestrated a criminal scheme to corrupt the 2016 presidential election," as prosecutors told jurors on Monday during opening statements in the first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president. "This case is about criminal conspiracy," said prosecutor Matthew Colangelo to the 12-person jury and six alternates whose selections concluded on Friday of last week. Trump, he said, conspired to corrupt the 2016 presidential election by conspiring with his lawyer, Michael Cohen, and David Pecker, who was the publisher of the National Enquirer at the time. Then, quote, "he covered up that criminal conspiracy by lying in his New York business records over and over and over again," Colangelo said. Pecker was called as the first prosecution, as the prosecution's first witness following opening statements from both sides after Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, told the jury that his client was not guilty because there was no crime committed. Now, Pecker did not get to his relationship with Trump by the time the court day ended on Monday. The proceedings were called off early because a juror had an emergency dental appointment. It was scheduled actually to end earlier on Monday than usual Then the court usually ends anyway due to the Jewish Passover holiday. Happy Passover to those who celebrate. The district attorney alleges that Trump and Pecker and Michael Cohen, Trump's then personal lawyer and fixer, conspired to hide, quote, damaging information from the voting public. That includes allegations from a former Playboy model named Karen McDougal, who said she had a 10-month sexual relationship with Trump. Pecker's company, AMI, agreed to pay her $150,000 in a deal to essentially buy her silence, a practice referred to as catch and kill. Trump has denied McDougal's claims about that nearly year-long affair with Trump while his wife, Melania, was pregnant with their son. But prosecutors suggest they have audio tape that will back up the scheme the way Donald Trump and Michael Cohen were scheming together to get money over to AMI to make this payment. But the situation, according to prosecutors, then took on a much greater sense of urgency in October of 2016, when the Washington Post published the Access Hollywood tape, which caught Trump on a hot mic saying that he could assault women without their consent because, quote, when you're a star, they let you do it. Now, the judge, Juan Merchan, has barred the DA from actually playing that videotape for the jury for fear that it would be too prejudicial. But he has allowed the prosecutors to use the transcripts of the remarks from that tape. The prosecutor, Colangelo, said the impact of the tape was, quote, immediate and explosive. The defendant and his campaign were concerned that it would irrevocably damage him with female voters, and the campaign went into immediate damage control mode. It was around that time, then, that the National Enquirer heard that adult film actress Stormy Daniels was interested in coming forward with a claim that she also had a sexual encounter with Trump. Back in 2006, Trump, according to the prosecutor, was, quote, adamant that he didn't want that claim, which he denies, to become public for fear that it would be devastating to his campaign, even though, as the president claims, it never happened. But that claim would somehow still be devastating. Cohen, on behalf of Trump, then struck a deal to buy her silence, to buy Stormy Daniels' silence, for $130,000. It was election fraud, pure and simple, according to Colangelo. He said Trump's company couldn't just cut Cohen a check with the memo, reimbursement for porn star payoff. So they agreed to cook the books, he said, and they made it look like it was a reimbursement that was income given to Cohen for his legal services. The payments were classified as retainer agreement payments for Cohen. But, quote, there was no retainer agreement, Colangelo said. It was instead what they thought was a very clever way to pay Cohen back without being too obvious about it, he said. But what they did was a crime. Donald Trump is, quote, guilty of 34 counts of falsifying business records in the first degree, Colangelo concluded in his opening statement. Trump's attorney, for his part, Todd Blanche, countered in his opening statement that his client has committed no crimes at all. He said the only thing Trump did was sign checks for legal services rendered by his lawyer. Quote, the invoice is processed. Somebody at Trump Tower generated a check. The check was ultimately signed, and there was a record in the ledger, Blanche said. So what on earth is a crime? What's a crime of what I just described? Blanche asked the jurors. None of this is a crime, he asserted, adding that non-disclosure agreements like the one that Daniels signed are, in fact, legal. Well, maybe. But that's not what Donald Trump is actually charged with.
Right.
Yes, it's legal to pay off somebody to be quiet. What's not legal, at least according to prosecutors here, is to lie about it in your books.
You're not allowed to falsify business records, period.
He is charged with falsifying business records, not for paying off Stormy Daniels. He's charged with doing so 34 times to hide his payments to reimburse Michael Cohen with checks that were signed, by the way, by Donald Trump in the White House throughout the year in 2017. I believe there are 9 different checks that he signed to Michael Cohen to pay for this. To pay for this, not for legal advice on a retainer, as they were suggesting, after this scheme had helped Donald Trump become the president in 2016. As for the election interference argument, Trump's attorney Blanche told jurors, quote, "I have a spoiler alert. There's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy." So that's the argument from Team Trump. He did nothing wrong. There are no crimes here. And apparently he didn't even have an affair with Stormy Daniels or Karen McDougal of any type. Both of those women are expected to testify in the weeks ahead. And David Pecker, the head of AMI, the company that owned and published National Enquirer, is already on the stand, though his testimony was abruptly ended for the day on Monday, but will begin again on Tuesday during a break. It was either during a break or after the court had ended for the day. Donald Trump went out before the cameras and called Michael Cohen a liar over and over and over again, which, by the way, would seem to be a violation of his gag order in this case. There will be a hearing on Tuesday morning in court about 10 previous instances of Trump violating that gag order, according to the prosecution. And I suspect this will add another one to them.
It should.
So there are many more takeaways that thanks to the news that's not getting coverage from Friday, that I want to get to with my guest today, that I'm going to go ahead and kick down the road for today, because that story, the Trump story, is getting so much coverage from the mainstream press, understandably today, that for the moment, I'm not needed. We'll catch back up with that story, I suspect, in the days ahead, probably day after day after day for quite a while. So with that, let's take a quick break here, and we will come back with Stephen Greenhouse, veteran labor reporter and author, on the labor earthquake that may have been kicked off last week in, of all places, Chattanooga, Tennessee. That is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
This is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town.
Yeah, it is now. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Here was United Auto Workers President Sean Fain speaking to some very happy workers from Volkswagen's plant in, yes, Uniontown, Chattanooga, Tennessee, on Friday night after the results came in.
Many of the talking heads and the pundits have said to me repeatedly before we announced this campaign, you can't win in the South. They said Southern workers aren't ready for it. They said non-union auto workers didn't have it in them. But you all said, watch this. And you all moved the mountain. Another mountain moved. Another thing people said we can't do and we've done it because we stood together in solidarity and we stood up for justice.
Yeah!
You know, a few weeks back, I came down here to meet with all of you and talk about this fight. And I remember telling you all then that there's a path to victory. But nobody can walk that path for you. You have to walk it yourself. And tonight, you all took a giant, historic first step on that path.
That was UAW President Sean Fain speaking to workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee on Friday night after celebrating the his union's historic victory at the Volkswagen plant there in Tennessee. Fain, the president of the UAW, told the Guardian's Stephen Greenhouse that he was confident of more unionization wins at auto plants across the U.S., saying, quote, "The workers at VW are the first domino to fall. They have shown it is possible," Fain added during the interview on Sunday evening, saying, "I expect more of the same to come. Workers are fed up." The three-day unionization vote last week at Volkswagen ended on Friday, Greenhouse reports, with the union winning overwhelmingly, nearly 3-1, in favor of unionization at the plant in what is now the first time workers at a foreign-owned auto plant in the South have successfully unionized. The vote in Chattanooga was the first union vote in the UAW's ambitious $40 million campaign targeting 13 automakers, including VW, Mercedes, Tesla, BMW, Toyota, Nissan, and Hyundai, with a total of 35 non-union plants across the U.S. As we reported in some detail last week on the broadcast, the election came on the heels of the UAW's historic, wildly successful, months-long strike last year against all three of Detroit's big three automakers and resulted in huge gains for workers in both pay and benefits. The UAW's next scheduled unionization vote will be at a Mercedes-Benz plant in Vance, Alabama, where some 5,000 workers will vote in mid-May on joining the UAW as well. Mercedes has been considerably more outspoken against the union than VW was, with the top Mercedes official telling workers, "I don't believe the UAW can help us to be better." Last week's vote at the VW plant, however, came on the heels of an unprecedented joint statement from six Republican Southern governors the day before voting was to begin. They argued that unionization would be bad for workers and lead to a mass loss of jobs in the South. Workers appeared unmoved, however, though I should note that not all Southern governors joined in the anti-union statement. Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear tweeted that he was, quote, "proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with the UAW." But the unprecedented intervention by the Republican governors of Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina, and Texas was, well, unusual to say the least. They wrote that, quote, "unionization would certainly put our state's jobs in jeopardy." Nonetheless, it does not appear to have had the intended effect. Nonprofit media outlet More Perfect Union, which focuses on labor issues, asked non-union workers at the VW Chattanooga plant about that statement from the Southern Republican governors attacking their efforts to unionize before the results of the vote were known. Plant worker Isaac Meadows argued the governors were not looking out for the best interests of workers.
These governors, they talk about bringing these good-paying jobs to their states, right? Well, I'm all for bringing these jobs to the states, but, you know, after the point of sale, they never check in. What is a good-paying job, right? Mr. Governor, are you in here working? I invite you, come work with me one day, shoulder to shoulder, see what I see, talk to the people I talk to. You're going to realize these jobs are not keeping up with the economy. We've got people that can barely afford their apartments. You know, they have no dream of ever possibly buying a house the way the economy is. So what is a good paying job? I can tell you this is not it, you know. So invite these jobs to your states, great, but not at the expense of your constituents being considered cheap labor, because that's why these manufacturers come down here, because there's cheap labor. And so we're trying to convince people you don't have to be cheap labor, you know. We're not asking for $1,000 an hour, right? We're asking for something where we can live comfortably, not have to work 50, 60, 70 hours a week just to survive, and have time to enjoy our families, you know.
VW worker Sean Lawler described the statement from the governors as a political stunt.
Politicians shouldn't be telling us what we need and don't need and stuff like that. We elect them to do their job, and we're here to do our job, and they should just stay neutral as well.
How do you think you know, all workers should kind of measure any politician?
You know, they're not the ones coming out here working every day like we are. They're just silver spoon-fed people that's never worked a day in their life. And a lot of people here in the work blue-collar here, you know, kind of paid him no attention. So it was just a bunch of hogwash out here. You know, it was just a political stunt put on by these union-busting, anti-union people. And so we didn't pay no mind. Because we got our supermajority, so we're good.
And finally, Volkswagen worker Kelsey Smith was critical of his state's governor, Bill Lee, and his efforts to bring in other governors to bust the union effort in Chattanooga. But he seemed confident that the workers would overcome that last-ditch effort to block the union drive.
What was your reaction to them coming out and saying that?
First thing I thought was that, man, this is really big. You know, this guy's going outside of the state of Tennessee and gathering up others to stand behind him. So, you know, I don't really get political in it. It's not a political thing to me. I just look at it as a thing of where certain people just don't want good things for good people.
Why?
That's the question that I ask myself. Why? I mean, what's the big deal? So I really don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's a money thing. I don't know if it's a political thing. I don't know. All I know is that I'm voting yes, and we're going to be victorious. That's what I know.
Well, in fact, they were victorious in Chattanooga last week, and it wasn't even close. UAW Chief Sean Fain over the weekend said that he was equally optimistic about next month's election in Alabama at that Mercedes plant, telling the Guardian's Stephen Greenhouse, quote, "At the end of the day, I believe that workers at Mercedes definitely want a union," adding, "I believe a big majority there will vote in favor." If so, as Georgetown labor historian Joseph McCartan told Greenhouse last week, quote, "Victories at both Volkswagen and Mercedes would be nothing less than an earthquake and the biggest breakthrough in private sector organizing in decades. It would mean," he said, "that the anti-union citadel in the South that has repulsed effort after organizing effort has been breached." Joining us again today is Stephen Greenhouse, longtime labor reporter for The New York Times, now writing at The Guardian, and the award-winning author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker, and his latest book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Oh, Mr. Greenhouse, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Nice to be here, sir.
Great to have you. You know, last time we spoke with you, Stephen, it was a pretty grim topic, as I recall, on the move by a bunch of huge American corporations to get the corrupted right-wing U.S. Supreme Court to declare the National Labor Relations Board, which oversees union elections and contracts and so forth, to be found unconstitutional. So I am happy to have you on to discuss something a bit brighter today. If the former president of the United States was not facing his first day of criminal trial today, Stephen, I'm fairly certain that what happened in Chattanooga on Friday would have been all over the top of the news on Monday as the potential earthquake you describe it as in your reporting for The Guardian. How big a deal is what happened last week in Tennessee as you see it, and why is it such a big deal?
So it's a very big deal, not as big a deal as the Trump trial, mind you.
Okay.
But it's a big deal because unions have had a very hard time organizing the South. Indeed, unions and union leaders are often told, you know, it's impossible to win in the South. Don't even bother. They're also often told it's very hard to win unionization elections at a factory because factory workers are so worried that if they vote to unionize, the plant will close and move overseas. So this victory bursts through the citadel, mm-hmm. breaks down the tradition of all these losses in the South. The past 10, 15 years, the UAW has tried several times to organize other auto plants in the South. It lost twice at Volkswagen in Chattanooga, where it won last week. It lost at Nissan in Mississippi. It mounted several drives at Mercedes-Benz in Vance, Alabama, that petered out without an election. So, this finally shows that you can win. And I think it's going to give real, so the UAW has announced that it's mounting a extremely ambitious organizing drive aimed at 13 companies with non-union plants in the U.S. Those 13 companies, as you said, Toyota, Nissan, Tesla, mm-hmm. Hyundai have 36 plants. Now there are 35 non-union mm-hmm. plants, and 150,000 workers. So Sean Fain very much says, now that we won at VW, that's going to give us momentum to win in Mercedes next month. And they're also hoping to win at BMW in the near future and Hyundai in the near future. So, this gives a lot of momentum, a lot of energy, a lot of inspiration to, auto workers, but I think also to the larger labor movement. Sean Fain, who's been president of the UAW for just a year, has kind of rocketed to become, in just that 1 year, in many ways, the nation's most prominent labor leader. He was, he got Joe Biden to walk on a picket line. The first time a sitting president ever walked on a picket line. He was Joe Biden. Fain was Joe Biden's guest at the State of the Union, and he's a very good charismatic speaker. I mean, you just quoted this, his 6-minute speech on Friday night at mm-hmm. the Volkswagen celebration. I mean, that was a terrific speech. I listened to it. When I interviewed him the other day, I said, "This is the first time I've heard you as a happy warrior, sir." He's usually a very confrontational, up against the wall, tough guy, and he realizes this is an important win.
Well, let me talk about that win, and I want to talk some more about Fain as well. But you mentioned that there were two other unionization votes at this very same plant in Chattanooga that failed about 10 and 15 years ago. They both failed. Why did those elections fail? But what's the difference now with this latest one last week? Why did it succeed and frankly succeed wildly? I mean, it wasn't even close. What has changed over those years for the labor movement and for this plant in particular, since it's pretty much an apples to apples comparison with just 10 years ago when a similar effort lost?
Good question. So first, the big reasons why it won now is that Sean Fain is this kick-ass new president who has really transformed the union. And secondly, the union won very big after last fall strike against General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis owns Jeep and Chrysler, getting 25% raises and into two-tier wage systems, better pensions. And the VW workers said, we want that. So they were eager to unionize. Now, going back to the first effort to unionize at Volkswagen back in 2014, at the time, the United Auto Workers was really known as a union that in recent years, was granting concession after concession after concession. And during the 2008 recession, when General Motors and Chrysler filed for bankruptcy, mm-hmm. the UAW granted a two-tier wage system, that pissed off a lot of workers because it meant that, newer workers would never earn as much as senior workers. Mm-hmm. It agreed to wage freezes, and the UAW had developed a reputation as a union of concessions, not a union that's really winning big. So in 2014, the workers said, we're not sure what the UAW would do for us. Mm. Second, in 2014, it was a fairly new factory, and it had just one production line, and it really needed a second production line to thrive and, mm-hmm. and for the workers to be sure that this plant is going to survive and live. And the governor of Tennessee, a Republican named Bill Haslam, basically told the workers, if you vote to unionize, we, the state of Tennessee, are not going to give you $300 million in promised subsidies to enable construction of a second production line that would ensure the long-term survival of the plant. So that scared the bejesus out of a lot of workers. Another big reason. So the workers narrowly voted against. Fast forward to 2019, when there's a second plant-wide unionization election. You know, at the time, the UAW was still known as a union that wasn't winning big, that was granting concessions, and then making things worse, it had a horrific corruption scandal. The UAW had been known for decades as a very honest union, but in the past 10 years, it had two corrupt presidents, both who went to prison or sentenced to prison. Some, you know, a dozen or so UAW officials embezzled more than $3 million. 12 of them were sentenced to prison. So between the reputation of being a union of concessions and a union that was corrupt, again, in 2019, the workers voted down the union. Now, this time around, you know, Sean Fain, who was elected, who became president of the union last March, really said, I'm bringing a big broom to sweep things away. We're no longer going to be the union of concessions, and we're going to be a very clean union without corruption. And you know, and people were excited that there's a new sheriff in town in ways. And after he won, he and the union won hugely in the strike against GM, Ford, and Stellantis, that really excited workers. And he knew that he could use the huge victories versus the Detroit Big Three automakers as a springboard, as kind of an advertisement to try to get workers at Volkswagen and Mercedes and Hyundai and Toyota in the South to unionize.
According to your reporting, Fain was pretty direct in his opinions regarding that statement from those six governors, calling them, quote, liars, who he described as, quote, puppets for corporate America, the, quote, don't give a damn about working class people, even though workers are the ones who elect them. How unusual was that joint statement opposing the union vote by six Republican Southern state governors? And before you answer that, I'd like to name them. That would be Tennessee's Bill Lee, Alabama's Kay Ivey, Georgia's Brian Kemp, Mississippi's Tate Reeves, South Carolina's Henry McMaster, and Texas's Greg Abbott. They all came out in this joint statement, all suggested that workers were going to lose their jobs if they voted in favor of unionization. That while I noted Kentucky's Democratic Governor Andy Beshear said he was proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with the union. So how unusual was that statement from those six governors literally the day before voting was to begin last Wednesday?
It was quite unusual. I think, you know, Tennessee's Governor Bill Lee really wanted to, you know, roll out some, quote, big guns, unquote, to help persuade and maybe even scare the workers not to vote for the union. And when I first read the letter, I kind of gritted my teeth because, you know, these six governors accused the union campaign of being driven by, quote, misinformation and scare tactics. And then this governor's letter goes on to say that the union is a third party and the union is a special interest. And I thought, this is kind of misinformation about a union. You know, unions are generally the workers themselves, the, you know, the 4,300 workers at VW, you know, forming a union. You know, they're the union. They're not outsiders. They're not special interests. They're trying to win better wages for themselves and their family. So I felt that it was the governors who are guilty of misinformation scare tactic. You know, they said, oh, if this place unionizes, it's going to destroy our state's business climate. You know, jobs are going to leave. Companies are not going to come. And Sean Fain rightly got angry, and he really lashed out at the governors. He said, you know, these people are just puppets of the billionaire class and the corporate class, and they don't really care about working class Americans. They don't care that the billionaires are raking up tons of money and the workers are being left behind. The workers, you quote, you know, who elect the governors. So it's interesting that Fain doesn't back down.
No.
He gave the governors, as you know, he really fired back very hard.
Yes, he just called them liars, just puppets for corporate America.
Kate Ivey, the governor of Alabama, wrote a letter a few months ago when it became clear that there's going to be a new unionization drive at the Mercedes plant in Vance, Alabama, outside Tuscaloosa. And she said, oh, woe is us. The union's going to try to come in and it's going to ruin the economic model that's made Alabama such a success. And then Fain gave a speech saying, what's the economic model? You know, where billionaires rake in all the money and the workers get screwed. You know, right. Workers are tired. They're fed up. They don't like this model. They want a new model. And he's very effective and quotable and punchy in getting his point. I mean, he's, you know, there are, you know, some union leaders I listen to, like, you're like, oh, when is there going to come a sentence that's colorful and quotable?
Right.
And Fain, like, every word out of his mouth are like, oh, that's a great quote. That's a great quote. I mean, it's important to have union leaders who know how to speak, who know how to speak color, you know, who speak colloquially, who that workers relate to.
Yep. Stephen, you cited a labor historian describing it, quote, anti-union citadel in the South up until now. I'm wondering why that citadel even existed. As someone who has studied labor now for so many years, why does that exist in the first place? I mean, it's not this plant now in VW is not the only unionized auto plant in the South, but they are few and far between. Why has the union movement had such a difficult time in the South, not just in the auto industry, but in a bunch of industries, at least up until now, as you see it?
So in the South, as you all know, has had a horrible history, legacy of slavery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after the Civil War, the 13th Amendment ended slavery, employers in the South continued to want to maintain a system of very low wages, mm-hmm. Sharecropping. And the South was generally always more anti-union than the North. I think the North of the United States had, you know, many people from Germany and Sweden and Finland and France and Britain who mm-hmm. kind of, you know, believed more of a social contract, you know, had more of a union tradition. But the South was, you know, the employers just felt much more unfettered in trying to maintain low wages. I think the business class had more power over state governments and more influence in the South than generally the North. Not to say that business doesn't have a lot of power in the North, but the South, you know, it seems that the governors are, are much more attuned to doing what business wants. And also, you know, the South is agricultural. They decided we want industry to provide good jobs. And they realized one way to do that would be to try to woo industry from the North. Mm-hmm. And it did that in two ways. One, by saying, hey, we have low wages, come locate here. Mm-hmm. And two, you know, we don't have much of a union tradition. We're going to do what we can to keep out unions. So, plants in Wisconsin or Minnesota move to the South, or Toyota, BMW, Volkswagen, if you want to move to the United States, you know, move to the South where wages are lower and where, people are more hostile to unions. And, you know, and I've written stories about, you know, unionization efforts in South Carolina and Tennessee and Mississippi. You know, whenever there's a unionization drive, it's not just a company that opposes it. And the governor usually steps in, and the state senator steps in, and the chamber of commerce, and sometimes some ministers. So, there's just, you know, I think, you know, the South is more conservative, I think a lot of powers that be in the South see unions as organizations for African Americans, just as they often say, the Democrat Party is the African American Party. Say unions are for African Americans, and they use that as a way to often turn whites against unions. One of the great things about VW and the Mercedes is, you know, when I interview people, when you watch the videos of what's going on, it's a wonderful cooperation between whites and African Americans, wonderful cooperation between men and women, wonderful cooperation between young workers and old workers. It's really a model for a more united, non-racist United States. It's kind of the opposite. You know, Donald Trump tries very, very hard to divide us.
Yeah.
And what the union is doing in the South is wonderful in the way it's uniting us, even if the governors disagree.
Let me, I've got just a few minutes here, Stephen Greenhouse. I want to talk about this effort moving forward. Tesla is another target of the UAW for unionization. I know you asked Sean Fain about that in your conversation with him over the weekend. Is Fain as optimistic about unionizing Elon Musk's company, and which is now the most valuable automaker in the nation, at least on paper? Is he as optimistic about that as he is about the various other plants seeking unionization in the South?
Sorry, I must plead guilty about something. I saw a quote a few days ago in which Sean Fain was discussing Elon Musk, and he said, Elon Musk is the worst person in the world. So I thought, you know, when I interviewed Sean Fain, I got to ask him about Musk and Tesla.
Uh-huh.
And he admitted that it'll be harder to unionize Tesla than, say, Volkswagen or BMW or Mercedes, which are German companies, and they have a tradition, you know, they have a union tradition. It's hard for German companies to be super anti-union without looking really, really bad at home.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Musk is vehemently, ferociously anti-union.
Mm-hmm.
And Fain admits it's going to be hard to unionize Tesla. But it was a surprise to me when Fain basically voiced optimism that someday we're going to win at Elon Musk's company. That he said that as we build our movement, unionizing more and more plants across the United States, it will become inevitably easier to win at a place like Tesla. And I thought that's big news that Sean Fain is even willing to voice some optimism about winning someday at Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's talking about winning at Tesla,
yeah,
you know, that means he's much more optimistic at winning at companies like BMW and Mercedes and Rivian and Hyundai and
mm-hmm.
so.
And, you know, it doesn't seem like it's going to help his case against his workers, the fact that the board of directors at Tesla right now is calling for Musk to be paid some $47 billion, which would be the biggest corporate pay package in history. Makes one wonder how you know, that sort of thing is going to go over for workers who are seeking pay raises and unionization if the boss just got a $47 billion pay raise. Stephen, what effect what appears to be happening in the auto industry, what effect will do you see that having on unionization in other industries, whether it's in the South or anywhere else? Because, boy, as you describe it, as Fain describes it, this sure does seem like a big domino has just fallen.
So if Fain gets this $47 billion raise or compensation package.
Musk, yes,
which would be the largest compensation package in the history of the world, corporate compensation package in the history of the world. I imagine workers would be very pissed off. Like,
right,
if this guy who's already worth 180, 190 billion gets another 47 billion, why can't we get a raise of 20 or 30, 40%?
Right.
And one of the reasons the UAW, you know, got a great contract last fall was that the CEOs of GM, Ford, and Stellantis got, you know, had taken raises about 40% over the past few years. So the Fain very wisely said, if they can get 40%, why can't the workers get 40%? So, you know, Fain, unlike some labor leaders, you know, doesn't hesitate to talk about corporate greed and greedy CEOs, because he sees talking that way helps rile up and mobilize workers to support a union.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he talks in a real, you know, the working class has to get its fair share. And then he talks in class conflict terms.
I think it's going to be like a showdown between Musk and Fain by the time they get to Tesla, because they both have these sort of huge platforms and are both very outspoken, just to put it nicely, in Musk's case. Yeah. But I'm still wondering what the effect all of this has on unionization in other industries, and why this is happening now. What is it after so many years of arguably contraction and of the labor movement, and, you know, sort of becoming dormant over the past 40 years or so? Why are we seeing what appears to be a new expansion happening now? What has changed?
Okay. So I'll give you 10 reasons in 2 minutes. So, okay. You know, I think during the pandemic, a lot of workers felt that they were taken advantage of, that they had to report to work and risk their lives every day while, you know, and they're getting paid $10, $12, $14 an hour and barely making ends meet, while the white collar workers who are making $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year, the CEO is making $10 million a year, work safely at home. So they were pissed off. And they felt that we weren't even given, you know, hero pay, hazard pay to award us. Also, I think Americans increasingly saw that income inequality has gotten ridiculous. And they say, they see the BMW, Mercedes and River Cruise ads on TV and they say, you know, WTF, I can never afford that. You know, I can hardly afford to pay the month's rent. And people have gotten more impatient. And certainly the inflation that was caused by the pandemic, the supply chain problems, the war in Ukraine, pushing up oil prices, agricultural prices, you know, that's another reason people wanted, more people supported, you know, young people, you know, they feel, they hear that they're not going to do as, they'll be the first generation in American history not to do as well as their parents. They say that sucks. How do we change that? And they see unions, they see unions as a tool to change that. I often talk about the Bernie Sanders effect. I think a lot of young people were really inspired by and influenced by Bernie when he ran for president in 2016 and 2020, talking about, you know, how insane income inequality is and what are we going to do about it, and that unions are something to do, you know, are an effective tool to help, you know, pull up, help raise one's standards. And people see that, you know, the public approval of unions is way up, the highest it's been since the 1960s. You're the most union, most pro-union president perhaps in history, or certainly since FDR. So, you know, in ways, the wind is at the, you know, is at the back of unions right now. And that's why, you know, we saw the Starbucks victory, you saw the Amazon victory. You know, today I got an email, REI workers in Santa Cruz, not far from where you are, voted to unionize overwhelmingly, something like 31 or 33 to 12. The REI store in the country to unionize. Trader Joe's are unionizing. Apple stores are unionizing. I saw Patagonia unionized, I think, in New Mexico. So, you know, things are really percolating.
You've got a book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Have we seen any similar movements like this, any similar sort of surges, you know, in the nation's labor union history that might inform us about what is happening now? Have we seen anything like this before?
Yes, especially during the Great Depression. Of course, you know, unemployment rose to 25% in the 1930s. You know, a lot of workers were, you know, their families were, you know, were really hungry. People were, you know, eager for improvement at work. A lot of workers are going on strike. A lot of workers are protesting how awful things were. Federal government passed a law that created a federally guaranteed right to strike, the National Labor Relations Act. Soon after, the United Auto Workers were formed. They went on a big historic strike at the end of 1936, 1937 at GM, closing down some of GM's most pivotal plants, so that once you shut down those plants in Flint, Michigan, it really essentially shut down all of GM around the country because those plants weren't getting the parts they needed. So that was a 6-week strike, and as you know, the GM, the UAW strike, you know, last year was also a 6-week strike, but that strike, sit down strike, which was, you know, front page news across the United States, you know, got General Motors, then the nation's largest company, to recognize the union, to negotiate with the union, to sign a contract with the union. And after that, you know, the nation's biggest company, one that for years was extremely anti-union, once they unionized, there was a flood, a wave, a tidal wave of unionization. There are many other sit-down strikes, many other, you know, hundreds of other companies unionized. And, you know, I think in the last year or two of 1930, suddenly 3 million more people unionized, and that's a good bit.
Finally, Stephen, next month, I guess, in May, Mercedes-Benz plant in Vance, Alabama, is going to have a similar unionization vote. Do you expect that they will have a similar success that VW had in Chattanooga this past week?
I think they will win in Mercedes. I think, you know, workers are really jazzed by the success at VW. I think the workers are also excited by the UAW victories with GM, Ford, and Stellantis. And they say, boy, that union won so much more from Detroit automakers than we get from Mercedes or VW, that we want that.
Mm-hmm.
One difference, though, is Mercedes is fighting much harder against the union than Volkswagen is.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when I asked Sean Fain about that, he said, we're still going to win. People know the company's tricks. People are used to these anti-union consultants. They know what to do. We're going to win. So
he hasn't been wrong yet in these in his estimations of these things. Stephen Greenhouse is a journalist and author. He focuses on labor in the workplace at theguardian.com, where you can find his work. You can also find him on the Twitters at GreenhouseNYT. And his newest book is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Depending on how things go next month in Alabama, Stephen Greenhouse, we may be talking to you again soon.
Sounds good.
Thank you, sir. Okay, I feel beaten down and worked up, Desi Doyen, after trying to get through today's show with everything going on. I'm sure it'll all slow down and make much more sense tomorrow, right?
Well, hey, at least there's the victory for the union members in Chattanooga.
Huge victory.
Big deal.
Not just for Chattanooga, but I think we're going to see this spread all across the country, which is very exciting, at least to me. All right, we got to get out. My thanks again to Stephen Greenhouse and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, where there is no paywall. You can drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter. You will find me at the Brad Blog. Could you tell I had Elon Musk on my head at that point? All right, that's it. We will see you tomorrow. Same Brad time, same Brad channel. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.